We're taking another trip back in time today, thanks to the Americans United for Life archives. We journey today to Chicago. We're heading into the AUL 1986 Forum on Commitment for Life to hear from two of America's pro-life advocates. Our first speaker is Maura Quinlan, Chief Staff Counsel of Americans United for Life. And our second speaker is Dr. Bernard Nathanson. But the first voice we hear is that of Cal Thomas, author, columnist, and political commentator, who is emceeing AUL's conference and introduces both our speakers. I am Tom Shakley, and this is Life, Liberty, and Law. All right, welcome to Life, Liberty, and Law from Americans United for Life, where we advance the human right to life in culture, law, and policy. Again, we're journeying back today to AUL's 1986 Forum on Commitment for Life. We're hearing from Maura Quinlan, Chief Staff Counsel of Americans United for Life at that time, and Dr. Bernard Nathanson. Maura Quinlan of Americans United for Life speaks on parental notice protections for the health of American family life and the human right to life. Maura speaks on protections afforded by reflection periods prior to abortion, what we then called waiting period protections. Although so much has changed in America since 1986, so much when it comes to the human right to life, to abortion, to the relationship between rights and families and constitutional protections and the common good, so much of this conversation remains the same. And Maura Quinlan's remarks will be of particular interest to all you attorneys and pro-life law students. Our second and key speaker is Dr. Bernard Nathanson. Dr. Nathanson, who passed away in 2011 at the age of 84, was an American medical doctor and co-founder in 1969 of NARAL, the pro-abortion organization. NARAL originally stood for the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws. Today, NARAL is known as the National Abortion Rights Action League. Dr. Nathanson practiced in New York, was board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, and was at one time the director for the Center for Reproductive and Sexual Health, which was at that time the largest freestanding abortion business in the world. Dr. Nathanson was a prolific abortionist. However, by the mid-1970s, with the emergence of ultrasound machines, Dr. Nathanson underwent a profound conversion of conscience on the issue of abortion. For the first time, ultrasound machines allowed for Dr. Nathanson and other doctors to witness abortions occurring in real time, particularly with respect to the tragic dismemberment and extraction of the preborn child. So despite playing a pivotal role in the 1960s alongside Betty Friedan and others in advancing abortion, and ultimately culminating in the 1973 decision, Roe v. Wade, by the mid-1970s, Dr. Nathanson's heart was changing. He wrote at that time in the New England Journal of Medicine that, quote, "I am deeply troubled by my own increasing certainty that I had, in fact, presided over 60,000 deaths," unquote. Dr. Nathanson became perhaps America's most powerful advocate for the human right to life. He devoted the rest of his life and career to reversing the errors taught by Roe v. Wade. In his 1996 autobiography, Dr. Nathanson laments, quote, "I am one of those who helped usher in this barbaric age," unquote. In what we're about to hear today, Dr. Nathanson speaks of the then-recent 1986 Supreme Court case Thornburg versus the American College of Obstetricians. The 1992 landmark case Planned Parenthood v. Casey was still a few years off at this point. The Thornburg case that Dr. Nathanson speaks to in what we hear today, like the later Casey decision, concerned issues arising from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania's attempts to protect human life. We're heading back to a time when the fight for life was a bipartisan cause, whereas the 1992 Casey decision arose thanks to Pennsylvania's Democratic governor, Robert P. Casey's efforts to protect life. The lesser-known Thornburg case arose from the efforts of Governor Casey's Republican predecessor, Pennsylvania Governor Dick Thornburg. So we're journeying back to a time when Democrats and Republicans were working together to protect life and restore the human right to life. Two governors working together against the dictates of seven men on the U.S. Supreme Court. The Thornburg decision concerned provisions of the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act of 1982 that the Supreme Court at that time tragically and wrongheadedly ruled was unconstitutional based on the law's potential impact to, quote, deter a woman from making a decision that, with her physician, is hers to make, unquote. Dr. Nathanson speaks frankly about his experience from the perspective of a former abortionist. Dr. Nathanson eviscerates the Supreme Court's decision in Thornburg, and he says, quote, a decision for abortion has been made 99.99% of the time before a woman ever sees a doctor. The doctor, Nathanson says, merely acts as an instrument. Dr. Nathanson goes on to say that the phrase between a woman and her doctor also implies that the decision for abortion is a medical one. Actually, Dr. Nathanson says, in speaking to the facts on the ground at the time, quote, there are fewer than 100 abortions a year for purely medical purposes. 100, he says, out of 1.5 million. There are parts of Dr. Nathanson's remarks that might be tough to hear, but they're important to hear. And Dr. Nathanson's life and witness continue to serve as a reminder to all of us of the power of conscience and the gift of our humanity. All right, Cal Thomas is about to start the session. Let's roll the tape. Let's head in together.
Americans United for Life presents 1986 Forum on Commitment for Life. Thornburg, the antithesis of informed consent. Bernard N. Nathanson, M.D.
Maura Quinlan is Chief Staff Counsel for Americans United for Life Legal Defense Fund here in Chicago. She received her law degree from the University of Notre Dame in 1981 and has been with AUL for the past 5 years. Please, no alumni, or we'll solicit you for funds for the Alumni Association. Ms. Quinlan has been very active in abortion litigation in the federal courts at both trial and appellate levels, including the United States Supreme Court. In addition to her responsibilities, was that a little applause there for her effort before the court? I certainly hope it wasn't applause for the court itself. In addition to her responsibilities within the courtroom, Ms. Quinlan has drafted model statutes on various aspects of abortion. She is routinely consulted by pro-life legislators from across the nation concerning the constitutionality of pending legislation and has often been asked to testify in legislative hearings. I'm looking forward to what Maura Quinlan has to say, and I know you are too. Maura?
Good afternoon. As you have heard, the United States Supreme Court has decided to review another abortion case this term. I'm not on your program, but we thought that you might be interested in learning a little bit more about that case, how it reached the court, and what its impact will be, so I'll discuss it briefly. Hartigan versus Zabaras, the case the court will be hearing, involves the Illinois Parental Notice Law, which was passed in 1983. That law requires that parents be notified before an abortion is performed on their teenage daughter. Once notice has been given, the abortion must be postponed for 24 hours so that the parents will have some meaningful opportunity to discuss its ramifications with their child. However, if the parents already know of her decision to have an abortion and either accompany her to the clinic or provide her with a signed, notarized statement indicating that they have been notified, the child may have her abortion without delay. Should a minor wish to avoid parental involvement altogether, the law provides that she may file a petition with the court seeking judicial authorization for the abortion without her parents' knowledge. This law was challenged by abortionists who are represented by the ACLU and was held to be unconstitutional by a federal district court here in Chicago. The state appealed, and the Court of Appeals also held that it was impermissible for the state to require that a child wait 24 hours after her parents have been notified before obtaining her abortion. Relying on a 1983 Supreme Court case which struck down a provision requiring a 24-hour waiting period for adult women between the time that they were given certain information and the time of the abortion, the Court of Appeals determined that a waiting period imposed on minors would be equally impermissible. Although the Court of Appeals held that the law might be okay if the waiting period were deleted, it refused to allow the statute to go into effect until the Illinois Supreme Court issued more specific rules governing the judicial bypass procedures. The state filed an appeal with the Supreme Court on October 16, 1985, and almost a year later, on October 14th of this year, the Supreme Court agreed to review the lower court's decision with respect to the 24-hour waiting period. Briefing will take place in the next couple of months, and the case will probably be set for oral argument in early spring, with a decision coming down sometime before the end of the term. As you know, the Supreme Court, just a few months ago, reaffirmed its 1973 decision legalizing abortion virtually on demand throughout pregnancy. That decision, while superficially a defeat, marked the first time that four justices suggested that Roe versus Wade be reevaluated. The original decision was 7-2. Since this summer's decision in Thornburg, Chief Justice Berger resigned and Justice Rehnquist was elevated as the new Chief Justice. Justice Scalia was chosen to fill Justice Rehnquist's seat. Therefore, the court has changed composition, and Zabara's will be the first abortion case to be heard by the Rehnquist court. Although we do not expect the present court to use the Illinois case to reverse Roe, we are glad that the court has agreed to hear the case because we feel that the law is constitutional and that the court will uphold it. The court upheld a Utah parental notice case in 1981 law, and in 1983 upheld a Missouri law requiring parental consent before an abortion could be performed. Certainly a law that prevents a child from obtaining an abortion altogether, unless she has her parents' consent, is more burdensome than one that simply requires that her parents be notified before the abortion takes place. Yet, according to the lower courts, the Illinois law is too burdensome, while the Missouri law, consent law, is not. Apparently, the lower courts have failed to note the inconsistency between their position and the prior Supreme Court decisions. Therefore, there is a need for the Supreme Court to clarify its position so that the Illinois law and others like it may go into effect. The need for such laws is great. Often, parents only find out that their daughter has had an abortion when they are confronted with the complications of abortion, both physical and psychological. A California case that AUL is involved in is illustrative. The mother of a 14-year-old junior high student is suing the school district, her daughter's teacher, and the abortion clinic for arranging for and carrying out an abortion on her young daughter without notifying her. The mother was not aware that her daughter had had an abortion until she was called by the school and told that her daughter had been taken to the hospital for post-abortion trauma requiring surgery. Although pro-abortion forces are quick to call laws requiring parental involvement in a minor's decision an infringement by the state upon the minor's abortion rights, such laws, in fact, safeguard immature minors from making ill-informed decisions on a life and death question which may have serious long-range consequences for them. Minors who are embarrassed to tell their parents of their difficult situation often find that their parents are far more supportive than they had anticipated. The battle over this law is not, as the abortionists claim, between the state and teenage girls. It is between Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers and the child's own parents. And as between those parties, the state has chosen to throw its weight behind the parents who have their daughter's best interests in mind. In addition to protecting minors from making imprudent decisions and protecting parents' rights to raise their children, laws requiring parental involvement also reduce the teen abortion rate significantly. Studies conducted in those states which have these laws operating show that teen abortions have dropped 25% to 30%. I might add that, interestingly enough, the decrease in abortion has not been accompanied by a corresponding increase in births to teens. Therefore, it appears that the primary effect of such laws has also been to reduce teen pregnancy. This is not surprising in light of the statements of a minor who testified in a case involving the Utah parental notice law. When asked whether she had attempted to prevent pregnancy in the first place, she stated that she had not, because she knew that she could get an abortion without her parents knowing about it. Cases involving parental notice and consent are ongoing in a number of states, and AUL will continue to be involved in those cases. In the meantime, we're happy to inform you that the Supreme Court has decided to review the Illinois law, which was based on our model statute. We hope that the court will uphold the Illinois law and thereby eliminate some of the confusion that is present in the lower courts, and we will certainly keep you posted on developments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maura, for that update and legal briefing. I'm glad I'm not a lawyer and opposing you in court. It's a great privilege for me to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Bernard Nathanson. You'll notice that in introducing these people, I'm not being repetitive and reading their biographies, which, presuming that you all can read, you can do for yourselves. You know who Dr. Nathanson is. You know his record. It's always interesting to me that the other philosophical viewpoint used to quote him often and at length when his position was different than it is now. But now that the empirical evidence has caused him to come to another conclusion, they not only no longer quote him, they tend to denigrate him as an expert. It seems to me if he was worth calling on as an expert in the first instance, then his integrity and expertise have not diminished because he has put politics aside and allowed empirical evidence to determine his conclusions. To me, that is one of the great definitions of integrity of our time. I first had the opportunity, though aware of him by reputation and having read some of his writings, to meet Dr. Nathanson a couple of years ago when, in a previous incarnation, I had the pleasure and privilege of participating in the first network television broadcast in total of the entire film of The Silent Scream, a major breakthrough in the conveying of empirical evidence to the American people. He is on the verge of an even greater technological and informational breakthrough. I don't know if he's going to talk about that much today, but I do know that whatever he talks about, it's going to have the authority and impact of the experience and expertise that he brings to this subject. So it's a great personal privilege and pleasure for me to introduce to you, to speak to us, Dr. Bernard Nathanson.
Thank you, Cal. First, I want to apologize to Cal Thomas and Nat Hentoff for my lack of face feathers. I'm going to step up the testosterone and I'll be all right. And I wonder, can you all see me here behind this? Only Cal Thomas, who doubles as center for the Knicks at night, can be seen behind this thing. But anyway, I do want to thank him for what really was an extravagant introduction. And such introductions, one hardly knows how to respond to. I suppose if my father were here, he'd be amused by it. My mother, of course, would believe every word of it. It is very difficult to know how to address what is predominantly a group of lawyers. It reminds me of the old story about Al Smith, who was a governor of New York State. He went up to an upstate prison to address the inmates. And he started off by saying, "My fellow citizens," and then, of course, he realized that they're all felons and they aren't citizens anymore. So then he said, "Well, my fellow convicts." No, that didn't work either. So he just said, "Oh, the hell with it. I'm glad to be here, and that's what I'm saying to you here now." It is really great to see such a large crowd. That's always flattering to those of us who are participating in the program, but then I have to keep remembering what Churchill once said. He said, "Wonderful to see such a large crowd here to see me," but he realized that if he were being hanged, there would be a crowd 10 times as large. So it is difficult to ask a doctor to discuss legal questions, and that's precisely what I've been asked to do today, to talk about the Thornburg decision It's kind of like the old story about the doctor saying to the lawyer, I don't say all lawyers are crooks, but your profession certainly doesn't make angels out of men. And the lawyer, of course, said, well, I'll have to admit that. You doctors certainly have the edge on us on that thing. Now, I want to talk to you briefly about this Thornburg decision. I'm going to confine my remarks to that. I think there are such wonderful ironies here in this opinion, such delicious paradoxes, inconsistencies, and hypocrisy, that I really think they deserve a couple of minutes of our time. You know, the case was brought by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, of which, unhappily, I am a member. It has a long and inglorious history of abortion advocacy. And the opinion, or at least half of it, is taken up with a lot of dithering and waffling about informed consent before an abortion. This is one of the major key issues in the whole opinion. Now, as physicians, and particularly as gynecologic and obstetrical surgeons, we have an understanding of informed consent. We feel, and I speak for my colleagues, and I may be presumptuous, but I've had some work in medical legal areas, and I think we understand the operative phrases in the term informed consent include the following: explaining reasonable and foreseeable risks without inciting the patient to such a frenzy that treatment might be deferred or even rejected. Now, that's a very simple definition, and I think it's our operative one, as I said. We are always, and again we, meaning physicians and surgeons in general, a little bit skeptical about the issue, however. And it brings to mind the study of Dr. Charles Bailey. Many of you probably don't know him, but he was a very well-known and pioneer heart surgeon in New York City. In another incarnation, Cal, in another incarnation, he quit medicine or surgery and became, I shudder to say it, a malpractice lawyer. But while he was one of the leading heart surgeons in the world, he did a study in which he taped his informed consent to every patient preoperatively. And his custom was to sit down with the patient in his office and give them at least a half-hour talk on the risks, the complications, the hazards, the post-operative course, the various recovery phases of the proposed heart surgery. And he taped every one of these talks to a consecutive 50 patients. He saw each patient 6 months after the procedure, again taping the interview. And he asked them at the post-operative six-month visit exactly what it was said, what he had said to them preoperatively about the informed consent. What exactly had I told you about the operation? Did I give you adequate consent? Did you know what you were in for? Fully half of the patients said he'd never said a word to them. And of course, with that, he pulled out the tape and played it for them, and they were astonished. So you can understand why we, as physicians are a little bit, or surgeons are a little bit skeptical about consent, although we do adhere to the rule and to the letter and to the spirit of the laws which regulate us. Now, the substance of the consent required under the Pennsylvania statute, and now I read from the Thornburg decision, required, among other things, that the physician doing the abortion disclose the name of the physician who will perform the abortion, the fact there may be detrimental physical and psychological effects, there may be particular medical risks associated with the procedure. You had to disclose the probable gestational age of the child, the medical risks associated with carrying the child to term if one rejected the abortion. The fact that medical benefits would be available to that woman if she rejected the abortion and chose prenatal care and delivery. And the fact that the father was likely to assist in support of the child once the child had been delivered. There was another part of the opinion which was interesting. Bear those strictures in mind, please, because I'm going to come back to them in a moment, as a good lawyer will. Part of the opinion dealt with an excoriation of the Pennsylvania law because, in the language of the opinion, the requirements that the woman be advised that medical benefits would be available and that the father is responsible for financial assistance, the support of the child, these are poorly disguised elements of discouragement for the abortion decision. Much of this would be non-medical information. That's how the court turned down that portion of the proposed bill. Now, let me show you Exhibit 1. This is a book entitled The Standards for Obstetric and Gynecologic Services. It would be unremarkable except that it is published by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the plaintiffs in this suit. And let me read to you from page 84 of this manual, published in 1982, on the subject of informed consent. The manual requires of all physicians who are members of the American College of OBGYN, and by the way, that is virtually everyone practicing obstetrics and gynecology in the U.S., the following. It is the physician's responsibility to inform the patient of the nature of the surgical and medical procedure being recommended. In most cases, the explanation should include the necessity of the treatment, the management alternatives, the reasonably foreseeable risks and hazards involved, the chances of recovery, and the likelihood of desired outcome. Adequate opportunity should be provided to encourage and answer questions, including those regarding, and I'm quoting right from the manual, non-medical issues such as cost. Now here is the opinion excoriating non-medical issues, and here is the plaintiff saying every doctor must discuss non-medical issues. It is suggested that a physician make a notation in the patient's record indicating the information communicated. Now, in page 13 of the opinion, the following is said. The opinion Thornburg versus the ACOG states, the proposed law is an attempt to wedge the Commonwealth's message into the privacy of the informed consent dialogue between the woman and her doctor. This is the judiciary branch of the U.S. government speaking. They are aware, they are exercised over the government getting into the relationship vis-a-vis informed consent between the woman and her doctor. I show you here Exhibit 2. This is a special sterilization form designed by the federal government and must be used in all cases of sterilization involving the use of government funds. This is a consent form devised only by the federal government. This is the federal government wedging itself into the relationship between the doctor and the patient. So this absurdity in the opinion is flatly contradicted by the actions of the federal government in devising its own consent form for one particular procedure. There is a lot of meaningless drivel in the opinion regarding decisions made between the woman, the woman and her physician. And I say this advisedly. This is meaningless drivel. Because, in fact, a decision for abortion has been made 99.99% of the time before the woman ever sees the doctor. The doctor merely acts as the instrument of her decision. The phrase between a woman and her doctor also implies that the decision for abortion is a medical one. Actually, one statistical study indicates that there are fewer than 100 abortions a year carried out for purely medical purposes. 100 out of 1.5 million annually. So the phrase between a woman and her physician is meaningless, and worse, it is even misleading. It implies that there is some variety of august summit between the woman and her physician. And in fact, really, the only discussion usually between the woman and the doctor about an abortion has to do with the cost of the procedure and the insurance coverage. You know, I was in London about a month and a half or 2 months ago, and I had the opportunity, I won't say privilege, but the opportunity to observe at a place called the Liam Clinic, which is an outskirt, a suburb of London, in Liam. This clinic specializes in doing late abortions. They will only do abortions between 16 and 28 weeks. They sort of are very good at it and specialize at it. I watched them work from 9 o'clock in the morning until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They did 30 late abortions in that time. They do it in two stages. Generally, they rupture the membranes on the woman after anesthesia is induced, pull down the umbilical cord, and just cut out a segment of the umbilical cord. The baby, of course, immediately expires, and then they send the woman back to her room for 24 hours, then bring her back the next day, and then pull the baby apart, the so-called D&E, which really stands for dismemberment and evisceration. I asked the abortionist why they did it in two stages, why they opted for this kind of procedure. And he said, well, I can explain it to you best, he said, by illustrating to you what happens if you try to pull a raw chicken apart. It's very difficult. But if you cook the chicken first, he said, then it becomes much easier to take it apart. This guy, this abortionist, showed me the procedure, showed me the whole set up in that clinic, took me out proudly to their anteroom where they had a large metallic machine. I asked him what that machine was. He said, well, we take all the parts, you see, and we mince them in this machine, and then they're flushed down into the London sewage system, so we don't have to deal with any disposal of parts. But to come to the point, I then asked him, well, look, this is a terrible procedure. It's formidable for everyone concerned. What kind of counseling do you give here? Oh, he said, that's easy. The counseling consists of one question. How much money have you got? How much money have you got? Now, why don't we take a look, a closer look, at the question of consent in abortion? I have here Exhibit 3, sticking to my legal protocol. I have two consent forms. These are from a major teaching hospital in the city of New York, major university center. One of these consent forms is a general consent form, quite specific, takes up an entire page. Those of you in the front tables can see this, and goes into every aspect of the procedure in some detail, or at least the generalities of the procedure. This is an abortion consent form. It is a special consent form. It is not very complete. It is rather, in fact, sketchy. The words abortion are in capital letters in the middle of this consent form. And in addition, this consent form deals with such matters as the disposal of the fetus or the products of conception. There are several questions which are of interest here. Why do we have two consent forms, one for everything else, hysterectomies, gallbladders, and the like, and one for abortion? You might consider that for a moment. You see, if anything, I think the abortion consent form, which is shorter, less specific, and less elliptical, is not necessary. We have here a procedure which is constitutionally guaranteed. I mean, hysterectomies or gallbladders are not constitutionally guaranteed. Why is it that we need a special consent form for this particular procedure? Incidentally, this form doesn't even speak of fetuses or even products of conception. It hurries by the whole issue, eyes delicately averted, by calling the unborn child, quote, materials, unquote. It's as if the poor lawyer who had to construct this form sort of wished the whole nasty mess would just go away. Well, one explanation you might advance is that we have two consent forms, one for abortion, one for everything else, because the framers of this particular abortion document were dimly aware that perhaps more than one party was involved here, that there were critical differences between this and, let us say, a hysterectomy in that respect. But consider this. Despite the fact that there are undeniably, two parties involved in any cesarean section, the woman and the baby, we don't have a special consent form for that. So one is left to wonder why this consent form was ever devised in the first place. Maybe, just maybe, there is some mystery about this procedure which these lawyers have not figured out yet, but has to do with something important, something unexpressed, something ineffable, but clearly something important and profoundly significant. There's a good deal of anguished hand-wringing here in this opinion over the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, as I said, wedging itself into the informed consent issue. And pro-abortion feminists naturally applaud this judicial angst. But let's consider something else. In the People's Republic of New York State, we have a statute which requires physicians to provide full disclosure regarding surgery for breast cancer, including all alternative modalities of treatment. That statute is very explicit and spells out exactly what the doctor must say to the woman who has breast cancer regarding the surgery involved and any alternative methods which can be employed. Number two, we have another statute in the People's Republic which says that all doctors must provide full disclosure of all the risks and hazards associated with any drugs administered to a pregnant woman in labor. Any drugs at all, which we may even contemplate giving. Now, these are two laws regulating informed consent in New York State. Feminists pushed both of these laws. They who execrate any interference between the woman and the physician in the issue of informed consent on abortion happily tolerate the state dictating to the doctor on informed consent for breast surgery and the pharmacological management of labor. Well, you know, government. Government is only efficient, someone once said, in doing two things: waging war and inflating the currency. Now, because there's been no challenge to these two statutes, the breast surgery statute and the drugs in labor statute, I suppose we're entitled to conclude that there are no constitutional guarantees to the right to breast surgery or to the use of drugs in labor. And speaking of guaranteed rights, my question has been over the past several years to pro-abortionists, publicly and otherwise, what kind of a right is it that requires the destruction of one life so that someone else can exercise that right? I mean, I'm aware that in the First Amendment we have rights to free speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, freedom of worship. None of these rights require the destruction of another human life to preserve it. Only that nebulous right in the Constitution, according to Blackmun, to abortion. Now, I see no violation of anyone's rights in the physician being required to explain, particularly in second trimester late abortions, the options where the child is clearly visible and viable. And by the way, I'll talk about viability in a few minutes when we get on to the rest of the opinion. As you know, we have three major methods of second trimester late abortion. We have the saline injection, in which amniotic fluid is taken out of the pregnancy through a long needle passed transabdominally, and saline, a saline solution, is injected into the uterus. We have the injection of prostaglandins into the uterus. Now, the saline method, while very reliable, is moderately dangerous and results virtually always in a stillborn child. The prostaglandin method is very reliable, very safe, and results often in a live-born child. And then, of course, we have the D&E, the dismemberment and evisceration. Now, the last method, of course, is in favor here in this country now for a variety of reasons. I will remind you of them, although I'm sure you're aware of them. Number one, for MD convenience. Convenience of the physician, because when you inject saline or prostaglandins, you don't know how much later that woman is going to abort, and you don't want to be getting out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning to attend an abortion. That is not a scheduled procedure for a doctor, and therefore that's one of the major physician drawbacks to that method. But in a D&E, of course, the doctor can schedule it in the operating room, carry it out, wash his hands, and go home. The second advantage of the D&E method, according to the abortionist, is that the patient is asleep and totally unaware of what's going on. Of course, this violates any concept of informed consent or cooperation of the patient, the woman, or anything else. It is, of course, more remunerative. And I want to remind this audience that there is no profession which has a more reverent regard for the dollar than mine. And finally, it is said by such pro-abortion purveyors as the CDC in Atlanta that the D&E is safer, that the morbidity and mortality is lower. This is probably true, by the way, up to 18 weeks. But after 18 weeks, the figures begin to cross. The prostaglandin method, which results in a live born, is safer, is more effective, and is all around a more satisfactory procedure. And in fact, many of you may know, we use prostaglandins at term to induce labor in perfectly normal, healthy women and babies. So it is a very safe method, and as I said, results in a live-born child. Now, we should be required then to explain such options to women. You know, some years ago, I indicated that I thought the answer to the abortion dilemma, the whole conflict, would be the devising of a surgical method efficient at extracting the already implanted, fertilized egg, dividing embryo, fetus from the unwilling woman and putting it into either another life support system or into another uterus. I proposed this maybe 5-6 years ago. It seemed visionary at the time. In fact, in veterinary medicine, this is now an ongoing procedure, and in human medicine, we are now having non-surgical ovum transfer. We are transferring embryos from one woman to another. I don't doubt that in the next 5 years, we will be able to do just that. Take the 6 week or 8 week or 10 week embryo, fetus, baby, from the mother's uterus, the mother who does not want it, and transfer it either to someone else's uterus or to a life support system. Now, the interesting question which will arise, among many other questions, will be that when a woman presents herself for abortion, given that technology is an operative technology every day, what kind of an abortion will American women opt for? Will they opt for the old-fashioned kind of abortion in which the suction is used and the baby ground to pieces? Or will they opt for this other kind of abortion in which the baby will be saved and their rights respected in that they will no longer be harboring an unwanted pregnancy? Now, this will be very revealing as to the moral tone of our society. And I'm very interested in what the moral style setters would say on that proposition. Let me talk a little more about informed consent. I have talked about on many public occasions the necessity for using ultrasound before any abortion. I think it should be part of the informed consent for an abortion. I think every woman should see that child on the ultrasound screen. And in fact, you know, it is part of the amnio procedure now. And in amniocentesis, most women do see the baby on the ultrasound screen during the amniocentesis. And by the way, pretty soon we will have what is called MRI as a commonly used procedure. This is magnetic resonance imaging. This is far more stark, far more vivid than ultrasound. It shows you the baby right on the screen in full color and detail. And I think that will be the standard, the gold standard, in a few years to come. And I would propose that every woman have that procedure before she goes for abortion. I'll remind you that Fletcher and Evans from the National Institute of Health 3 years ago published a study in the New England Journal of Medicine in which they took a group of women who came to an abortion clinic and opted for abortion, and they showed them the babies on the ultrasound screen. These were women from 6 to 10 weeks pregnant. And in every case, the women turned around and left and did not have the abortion. The conclusion of Fletcher and Evans was that these women underwent a mysterious kind of bonding between themselves and that baby on the ultrasound screen and therefore rejected the abortion. And in the very same issue of the journal that month, February 1983, there was a letter from a doctor named Wolf Utian in Cleveland, who was running an in vitro fertilization program, and he indicated that even in vitro fertilization programs, there was bonding between the doctors and the fertilized dividing egg in the in vitro solution. That if an egg died, if it expired, there was a great sense of loss among not only the doctors involved, the laboratory technicians, the x-ray technicians, the surgical assistants, the nurses, everyone involved in the project really felt that they had lost something important when that little fertilized egg died. The letter is a matter of record. I proposed that all women have ultrasound before abortion some years ago when I testified in front of a Senate committee. There was a doctor there who vigorously opposed me. He was chief of perinatal medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, styled himself as the physician to the fetus. And when I asked him, well, you are a physician to the fetus, how can you endorse the systematic decimation annually of one-third of your constituency? He did not reply. He simply gave me a look that the porridge dispenser gave to Oliver Twist. To this day, by the way, he swears there's no personal animosity between us. Nothing personal at all, he said. And I'm just simply reminded of what Oscar Wilde once said about such people. He said, well, he said, this fellow has no enemies, but his friends dislike him intensely. More on informed consent. From the CDC, 5,000 serious complications from abortion every year in this country. 5,000. We're not talking about infections. We're not talking about bleeding. We are talking about perforations, hemorrhages, hysterectomies, deaths. Those data are not included in the usual and customary informed consent in abortion clinics in this country. It is still abortion, legal abortion, is still the sixth leading cause of maternal mortality in the United States. And I have been asking Planned Parenthood for years, what have you accomplished with legalizing abortion? Instead of women dying in those terrible back alleys you so dearly love, they are now dying in nice, clean, profit-making abortion clinics. What have you accomplished? There are a couple of more interesting paradoxes in this whole opinion. And they would be amusing if the situation were not so grave. You know, a French general once said, when he was losing a battle in the First World War, the situation is desperate, but not serious. We have laws requiring pregnant women in the workplace to be fully informed regarding occupational hazards to the fetus. Now here, the state, which by the way consistently denies it in the Roe decision, confers moral status on the unborn. No question about it. The state has now conferred moral status on the unborn when they pass such laws in the federal regulations. But if a woman opts to terminate that pregnancy, then the moral status confirmed by the state is nullified and denied by the whim of one person. It's only in the area of abortion that the moral status of a person is so evanescent and unstable.
Please stop your machine at this point and turn your cassette over for side two.
If an owner, for example, donates his dog to an experimental laboratory, the changed circumstances of the dog do not in any way nullify its moral status. There are still very strict federal regulations about how laboratory animals must be treated, and there are laws protecting that dog from abuse and regulating its treatment. So that no single person's whim, the owner, the laboratory proprietor, the scientific investigator, can change that moral status arbitrarily. It brings up the question of why are people who are selling alcohol to pregnant women not sitting down and counseling them about the risks of alcohol? That's a drug. It requires an informed consent. Cigarettes the same. Although there's a package warning, this is clearly not sufficient. More interesting paradoxes. I'm just going to give you a couple of these and then sit down, but there are some that are really so delicious you've got to listen to them. Here's this baby operated on in San Francisco now. You probably read about it. About a year ago, this baby at 23 weeks, the mother's abdomen was open, the baby had a bladder problem, and the bladder was distending, and it needed an operation to save its kidneys. So the mother's abdomen was opened, the baby was half taken out of the uterus. Only, by the way, the bottom half, so the surgeons could operate on the bladder. The top half stayed in the uterus. And it brings up interesting questions. For example, was the baby only half born, or was it born coming out of the uterus? And the other question is, was the born backside a fully qualified person, whereas the brain half was not? Now, you know that what they did is they operated on the baby and then put the baby back into the uterus and sewed up her abdomen, and she went on for another 17 weeks and delivered. Now, this baby had already been born, so that brings up the question, was this a born-again baby? You see? By the way, I just want to warn this audience very seriously, that within 5 years, we will have what is called a placental bypass operation. We are going to be taking the baby afflicted with some congenital defect and surgically remediable
out of that uterus, put it on a table, connect it to a machine which will do the work of the placenta, and operate on the baby, and then connect up the umbilical cord again and put it back into the uterus, very much as people who have bad hearts and are having heart surgery are operated on and plugged into a heart-lung machine. This baby, in essence, will be plugged into a heart-lung machine. And then very interesting questions will arise as to its personhood, humanity, was it born, was it not born, and so on. Just be on the lookout for that little number when it comes down your way. Another interesting paradox, Pamela Ray Monson in San Diego. Here she is accused of child abuse for failing to call the doctor when she began to bleed in the 36th week of her pregnancy. Now she, as a result of the delay, and by the way, she had taken some drugs also during the pregnancy, but it's very doubtful these drugs had any significant effect on the baby. But as a result of that delay, the baby was born brain damaged and subsequently died. She now faces criminal charges for standing by while her baby succumbed. But if she'd gone to an abortionist at 36 weeks complaining about her varicose veins, and he had done the abortion, she would have been cited as having exercised her constitutional rights. There would be no question of criminal charges involved here. She would have just exercised her constitutional rights. There are other things which deserve a comment or two, and then I'm going to really sit down. The opinion dithers on about viability. You know, the definition in Webster, if you look up your Webster's, you'll see the following definition about viability. It says, the ability to live, grow, and develop. That sounds suspiciously to me like a pregnancy at the time of conception. And it covers a whole lot of ground, about 266 days worth. But in the opinion, the word viability is used without any qualification. We don't know what viability they're talking about. For example, 1949 viability, when I was a medical student and viability was 32 weeks. 1973, when Roe v. Wade came down the path and viability was 28 weeks. Today, 1986, when viability is 23 weeks. They don't talk about viability where? New York City? Algeria? Zaire? Where? They don't talk about viability. How long viability? What? 3 minutes is viability? 5 minutes? 2 years viability? 10 years? No talk about that. Just that loose, slippery concept about viability. You know, let me just tell you this about viability. Current hospital standards now dictate that we must have, at cesarean section, a pediatrician present in the delivery room. So therefore, at every cesarean section, we have at least three doctors, the surgeon, the first assistant, and the pediatrician. Now this is especially compelling and demanding. The pediatrician must be there when we're dealing with a cesarean section for a very tiny premature baby, a very fragile baby. Now here, why is the requirement, sticking strictly now to announced hospital standards, why is the requirement that two MDs be present at the delivery of the tiniest and most fragile preemie as a result of a second trimester abortion regarded as exotic and oppressive? Well, these, you know, are all these wonderful, almost endearing paradoxes, inconsistencies, hypocrisies, contradictions, absurdities. Absurdities. And I will close by reminding you of the words of Voltaire. As long as men continue to believe in absurdities, they will continue to commit atrocities. Thank you.
Excellent as always. He never disappoints. Is Robert Drolana in the room? Robert Drolana? Yes. Are you he? There's a message for you over here by the door if you'd be kind enough to pick it up. I think you'll be pleased. It is that time, yes. Yes, no, it's not the lottery. Well, in a way it is. I'll tell you what it is after he finds out what it is. Number two is on the way. That's right. Now, he guessed it. Yes, your wife's on the way to the hospital in labor. I want to thank Dr. Nathanson for confirming some of my analogies in my column tomorrow, which I hope, but I can't guarantee, the local paper is going to run.
You've just heard from Cal Thomas, Maura Quinlan, and Dr. Bernard Nathanson at the Americans United for Life 1986 Forum on Commitment for Life. Wasn't that powerful? We're so thankful for the generations of advocates who have made the work of AUL possible. We celebrate their continuing impact through our mission as we celebrate our 50th anniversary and plan for the work to come. And we invite you to stand alongside us at this time by becoming a new or monthly supporter of AUL by visiting AUL.org. I am Tom Shakley, and until next time, thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Law.